This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
Occasionally, we have a guest host, and today we have Fernando guest hosting for me. So I hope you enjoy this episode. It's fascinating. Dive in and enjoy, and make sure you visit us at hartmanmedia.com to check out all of our great shows, and be sure you have actually subscribed to the show so you don't miss any episodes.
Today, it's my pleasure to introduce Philip Muller. He's the aging columnist for Time and Money magazines, and the Ask Phil Medicare columnist for PBS. He's also a research fellow at the Center on Aging and Work at Boston College. He's the founder of Insure.com and co-author of How to Live to 100, Be Healthy, Be Happy, and Afford It. He's the author of the new number one New York Times bestseller, Get What's Yours, The Secrets to Maxing Out Your Social Security. And also, he's the author of a new book, Get What's Yours for Medicare, Maximize Your Coverage, Minimize Your Costs. Welcome, Phil. It's great to have you on the show today. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me.
Well, please give us a sense of geography. Where are you located?
I'm in Central Virginia.
Excellent. So I'm actually pretty excited to pick your brain on these topics, which are at the heart of our show. And I was looking at the Center on Aging work, and I like the vision statement in the website, and it says, to make longer life a better life. And this is exactly what this show is about. I think it's interesting that a lot of the Western medicine and the approach that is out there is for extending lifespan, but with a lot of dependence on drugs and with all of their side effects. What's your take on that?
My take is a little bit different. We wrote a Social Security book last year that became a bestseller, explaining how people can use this benefit program to get more money. Then I wrote a Medicare book that's just been published. And the reason I did these books is that Social Security and Medicare are the two most significant benefit programs that older Americans rely upon. And if you don't get these programs right, if you don't figure out how to maximize your Social Security benefits and how to get the most value from your Medicare health insurance, it's going to have a terrifically negative effect on your longevity. So we often focus in terms of longevity on scientific breakthroughs, occasionally on diet and lifestyle habits, but there's an enormously important financial component to longevity. If people don't have sufficient resources, their quality of life suffers. They normally exhibit substantial lifestyle stresses that have a clinically proven relationship to shorter lifespans. I think sometimes we forget about these types of necessary components to living a longer life. And I can tell you from doing the work on these books and interacting with thousands of readers, these two programs are essential for successful longevity.
Do you have tips for new retirees for the best Medicare approach that they can go for?
Sure. Just buy my book. That's why I wrote it. But let me just go into that. The answer is yes, but there's no one-size-fits-all answer. Medicare is a very flexible and potentially superior form of health insurance for older Americans. You know, before the Medicare Act was passed about 50 years ago, we created Medicare in 1965, so it's been around a little bit more than 50 years. Before Medicare came along, older Americans were the poorest demographic group in the country. Today, they're the wealthiest. And Medicare has had a lot to do that because It protects people against catastrophic healthcare expenses and also allows them, you know, to take the kind of care of themselves that you need to. Having said that, the kinds of Medicare policies a person needs are very much a function of their health, their age, their financial status, in terms of what makes the most sense for them. And the book goes into that in a lot of detail.
Just in general, does Medicare do anything to actually try to extend one's life?
Well, I would say indirectly it does. I mean, I don't think they put, you know, longevity insurance on, you know, on their website. But for example, the Affordable Care Act, when it was passed several years ago, included a number of Medicare provisions that expanded free wellness services that Medicare recipients can get. For example, you get an annual, what amounts to a wellness checkup with your doctor every year that Medicare pays for, especially in terms of women's health. There are a number of free or reduced price wellness services that Medicare will pay for. A lot of private insurance policies have them as well, but generally Medicare has a more complete set of these services. So to that extent, the people who shape the Medicare insurance regulations are trying to encourage people to take better care of themselves. And of course, the outcome of taking better care of yourselves is you'll live longer. Mm-hmm. So to that extent, practicing healthful habits, and to the extent those are encouraged by your health insurance, is clearly a longevity benefit.
We know, especially here, I lived in California and I live in Arizona, and there's a lot in the media that talks about insurance companies getting out of the Affordable Care Act, and it seems like it's definitely reducing the amount of choices. How does this affect Medicare, or does it affect Medicare at all going forward?
The state insurance exchanges, which are how the Affordable Care Act provides its coverages, are exhibiting the same kinds of stresses that private insurance plans have had to go through in Medicare. And to that extent, Medicare probably is sort of a instructive area that has helped inform private insurers about how they have to function in the state insurance marketplaces. Having said that, the two are fundamentally different because everyone age 65 or older generally tends to get Medicare. You have what's called a pretty complete risk pool. Whereas in the Affordable Care Act, it was set up so that everybody would get health insurance, but that's not what's happened. The penalties for not getting health insurance under the Affordable Care Act are so modest that a lot of healthy people would rather just pay the penalty and not get health insurance.
Right.
What that means is that the Affordable Care Act exchanges are tending to insure sicker people. Mm-hmm. But the premiums they charge aren't based on those sicker people. They're based on the broader pool. And so the insurance companies, in many cases, are losing money by definition because their rates are based on having a mix of ill and healthy people, and they're not getting enough healthy people. In effect, if you wanted to look back in time, what should have happened is that the penalties for noncompliance should have been much stiffer, but that was not politically feasible several years ago. I mean, people don't like to be told, you have to do this or you're going to pay me a lot of money.
Right.
So that's the fundamental problem with the health insurance exchanges. It's a very solvable problem. And to that extent, it's not really doesn't have an overlap with Medicare.
And how have Social Security laws changed that affected Medicare over the last few years?
They haven't. There have been significant changes in Social Security rules that affect the kind of benefits you can claim and the timing of when you might want to claim benefits. But generally, they haven't really had an impact on Medicare. The biggest area where the two programs overlap these days was exhibited just recently with the announcement of the cost of living increase for 2017 for Social Security. As you know, every year, Social Security provides a COLA to try to help retirees keep up with inflation. Mm-hmm. So your benefits will automatically go up every year to reflect the general levels of inflation. The last few years, we haven't had much inflation. And so there was no COLA last year for 2016. And when the 2017 COLA was announced recently, it's only 0.3%. that averages out to a whopping $4 a month for the typical beneficiaries. And of course, the real inflation that older people face is substantially higher than general inflation, because they buy different things, particularly healthcare. They are much larger consumers of healthcare. So the reason this affects Medicare is that most people on Social Security pay their Medicare premiums out of their Social Security payments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a rule that says that you can't decrease Social Security payments from one year to the next. Normally, what happens is higher Medicare premiums are paid out of that COLA every year. So, you know, if your COLA goes up $30 a year and your Medicare premium goes up $15 a year, you get $15 more from Social Security and the other $15 goes to Medicare.
Exactly.
That's how it works. But when the COLA is really small, there's not enough extra to pay that Medicare premium. And it's a very complicated set of rules. But the reality is that most Social Security recipients will not pay anything more for their Medicare next year in terms of these basic premiums. But there's a large group of people who are not protected by those rules. And when they get Medicare, they're going to have to pay a whole lot more money for their health care next year. And this creates a problem that's directly tied to low rates of inflation. And given that we're living in a low inflation economy, I think these rules need to be changed so that we don't end up getting into this kind of a problem every year.
Now, is there a right time to make use of Social Security benefits from what you see?
Sure. Again, if you're on the longevity train today, which I think you are.
Yes, we surely are.
You could claim Social Security as early as age 62, or you can wait and claim it as late as age 70. Every year you delay, your real benefits go up by a substantial amount. So, for example, if you were due like $2,000 in Social Security every month at the age of 66, if you claim at 62, you're only going to get $1,500 a month. So you lose a full $500 a month by claiming early. But if you waited from age 66 to age 70, you would get more than $2,600 a month from Social Security. And if you look at the difference between $1,500 at age 62 and $2,600 plus at age 70, it's an enormous difference. Given that people are living longer and longer on average, it makes a lot of sense for people to defer claiming Social Security. Now, having said that, longevity benefits, as you probably know, aren't exactly passed out evenly these days. People with lower incomes who have manually challenging jobs and frankly have a harder life to live are not participating in the longevity revolution. It's largely skewed along income and education lines. You know, there's a lot of talk these days about economic inequality. There's also longevity inequality. And to me, that's the more serious problem of the two, because not having as much money as the other guy is one thing, but dying before the other guy, that's another thing. And that's a big problem. So to the extent that you need to make sure you're taking utmost advantage of those Social Security dollars, I really think that they should be deferred until you need them. And in that effect, Social Security really is very, very strong longevity insurance, because these payments are guaranteed to you for the rest of your life.
So the key is live a longer, healthy life and delay your, assuming that the laws don't significantly change, is delay the time to make use of those Social Security benefits. Now, in longevity, as we talk about longevity, you wrote the book, How to Live to 100. What are the latest scientific advances that you see, and what can they do today to increase their chances of living a long life?
The big gains in longevity are actually not very glamorous. They come from basic improvements in how we do things like wash our hands when we're when we're going to perform surgery on patients. Childhood, the reduction of child-related deaths is a major driver of longevity. We tend to forget that. We look at these enormous improvements in longevity, but right now, for people who are already, you know, adults, the future changes are really going to be driven by incremental gains in treatment of disease, lifestyle habits, diet. And it's clear that people who practice those traits have a chance to extend their lives. The purpose of the How to Live to 100 book, at least the component of we did, was to say, as I did earlier in the show, there are a lot of behavioral activities that can enhance your chance for long life even more than inventing a new pill or developing some kind of treatment for an illness. And that's what we really tried to focus on in that book. And the portion of the book that I had to deal with related to happiness. How can people lead their lives in a manner that gives them more satisfaction and at the same time substantially reduces their stress? So from my standpoint, you know, one of the general rules I would give people is that stress is a killer in all sorts of ways you don't even realize. And stress reduction and stress management becomes an extremely important way to deal with life's challenges and to create the opportunity for you to live a longer life. And as an example, I talked to a number of social scientists around the world. It's really remarkable how these behavioral concepts can cause you to live longer. For example, living by yourself in isolation has the same adverse health impact as smoking a pack of cigarettes a day.
Wow, that is very significant.
It literally shortens your life. So one of the important elements to living a long life is to have active social relationships. And so I talked about the nature of relationships with family and friends, but it turns out that even the kindness of strangers, so to speak, can enhance your life. And there is research that supports the idea that people have less stress, more life satisfaction, and are healthier if they engage with some people they don't even know. And one of the examples that's the strongest one is the idea of this barista at your local Starbucks. You don't know their name. You go in there on a regular basis. They give you a smile. They start your morning off in a positive way, and they help you live longer because of that. And again, as I'm sure you're aware, the relationship between stress and sort of how your body produces chemicals and how your genes express themselves in terms of healthy or unhealthy manifestation, those are crucial to longevity.
Mm-hmm.
And so these sort of what I'll call non-scientific things are really what I think we need to focus on more and more. It's not that the scientific stuff isn't important, but you or my ability to influence the direction of that research and to even directly benefit from it is very modest, very modest. Again, over time, those discoveries, there's no doubt they help us a lot. But I think these behavioral traits really have the potential to really add more years to our lives than some of the scientific breakthroughs that we tend to get all agog about, right? Everybody
likes
to pay attention to the latest bells and whistles coming from the scientific medical community. And they're remarkable. There's no question about it. But I think that how you live your life is as important as the drugs you put in your body.
I agree 100%. It goes back to the basics. There's, as you said, there's plenty of research. We know that how important hormones, the natural hormones produced in the body control longevity, control your health. And simple things like hugging somebody raises your level of oxytocin. It's a
sure.
fundamental hormone, and you don't need a lot of scientific research and the new pills to make that happen. You know, you just have a circle of friends and have healthy relationships, and you can get that simple stress reduction.
It also turns out that people who deal well with adversity live longer.
Sure, yeah.
And so it turns out that you do have some control over how you respond to bad things. And it turns out that people who aren't good at dealing with adversity don't live as long.
Yeah.
You know, they have what I would call very harmful brain chemistry, you know, and that comes from often your fight or flight reactions and the related sort of neurochemical releases that are associated with how you deal with stress. And it turns out that people who aren't comfortable or haven't had a lot of hard times are often just slammed when they have an adverse event, as opposed to people who are sort of used to living in the real world and have figured out coping mechanisms that are good for them.
Yeah, they haven't built that immunity. It's a very good analogy with our own body. If we don't have that life where it teaches us about how to deal with adversities, and when they come, it's so hard, and people can adjust easily, and that shows. I've seen people who have this exact, either biologically, they show this exact syndrome, and of course, in the way they handle stress. Now, Phil, can you share some happiness secrets with us?
These aren't secrets from me. These are generally agreed upon secrets. People who engage in mentally demanding activities tend to be happy. They get lost in what they're doing. There's a psychological concept called flow.
Yes.
And when you're in the flow, so to speak, when you're doing something that you love, an example would be a pianist who rehearses and gets totally lost in the music. And it turns out that the more challenging the music is, the better it is. And they literally can be engaged in that for hours and not even be aware of the passage of time. People who do that tend to have terrifically more positive chemical sort of secretions, if you will, mm-hmm. in terms of that. As people become older, religion achieves a more and more important position in people's satisfaction and happiness with their later years. I'm not talking about organized religion alone as much as it is sort of a spirituality that causes people to be more content and at peace. And again, for the same reason that stress management is so important, having some sense of satisfaction with the direction of your life from a spiritual standpoint becomes very, very important. Music, especially singing, is a tremendous physical boon to your well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Especially choral music, where you're singing in groups, there's a reinforcement that's just really, really powerful. And as I alluded before, there's some other benefits too in terms of, as you probably know, research finds that people who continue to work in their later years are probably healthier for working than people who retire. And then in many respects, people who retire don't live as long as people who keep working.
Yeah,
retirement is not necessarily good for your health.
Exactly. No, I agree.
Keeping busy, keeping active, developing and maintaining those social relationships. So, for example, if you're 65 years old today, you should have a network of friends that includes a lot of younger people. It shouldn't just be people who are your chronological peers, because in 15 years, they're going to start dying off, and you need to have those relationships.
It keeps your brain young as well, with new ideas, and
Absolutely.
You're up to speed on what's going on. That makes a lot of sense.
Again, I'm sure you're aware. We used to think that physically, people really should just sort of lead a sedentary lifestyle as they get older. But again, that's not true. It turns out that people's ability to build muscle mass and strengthen their bodies never ends. You can weightlift in your 90s and still become stronger and healthier.
Yeah.
And so I think, again, you sort of, that synthesizes into a buzz phrase, it's on athletic apparel, but it's basically use it or lose it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, life is a contact sport. And if you want to live longer, you need to engage in life. You shouldn't be on the sidelines. You should get in there and continue to learn and grow and do new things.
Well, very well said, Phil. We are unfortunately coming up to the end of the interview and the end of the show. Please give out any URLs or links or pointers to your books for our audience.
The new book is called Get What's Yours for Medicare, and both the Medicare and the Social Security books have a combined website that's called getwhatsyours.org. And if people go there, they can find out everything they need to know about these topics. You're also allowed to tell 1,000 of your closest friends about my new books and buy as many of them as you like.
We'll definitely do that. And we're doing our part. So getwhatsyours.org is the website for the book series. I'm very glad to have you on the show and share your knowledge on these areas. I do appreciate it. It's been a pleasure, and have a good day, Phil.
Thanks so much for your time. My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to check out HartmanMedia.com for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.